Hey, you know, my name is Corlin. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 29th, 2002. Midtown Group Alcoholics Anonymous is my home group. I have a sponsor. I am sponsored. And I've been graced with the ability to sponsor other men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful for all those things. Dale, thank you for asking me to come out. I'm grateful that I was able to show up and do something that I said I was going to do. That's not what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also wasn't able to show up the night that you had originally asked me to show up, and I worked with you to get somebody else down here. Also, something I was not doing when I say before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but really not. I wasn't doing it when I got here for a little while. I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous and walk in the rooms and change. I said my sobriety date was January 29th. And as I understand it, my objective up here is to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And to the best of my ability, I will do that. And I don't speak for anybody other than myself. And if it's a good night, you'll get my experience and very little of my opinion. But I got here at the end of January of 2002. And New Year's before that, December 31st, I was in a hotel in DC, and out one window I could see the National Christmas tree, and out the other window I could see the White House. And I was there with my girlfriend, and I was there with my girlfriend's girlfriend and that woman's boyfriend, and truth be told, he was a coke dealer, and I was drinking and had the ability to do whatever I wanted all night, and I did. And in the morning, somebody that worked at the hotel helped carry me out of the room and carry me down to the curb outside the hotel and put me down. And the guy that was there with us all night, he sat there and said, he's like, man, I gotta lay off for a little while. And I said, for the first time that I can ever remember in my life, I said, I've got to stop. And I didn't know what I meant, but I was just like, I've got to stop. And that was the first, January 1st, 2002. And every day from January 1st, 2002 until the 29th, I was drinking and putting something in my body. I was incapable of not drinking. And that is not that's not the way it started for me. I don't know when my first drink was. My parents were active people. They were social people. There was a lot of drinking going on in my house. There was some other stuff going on in my house, but we were in and out of the house. There were always parties, things going on. I can't remember my first drink. I knew I took the sips of the bottom of a lot of beers. I can remember being in the woods at my middle school, drinking 40-ounce beers with high school kids. So I don't know when my first drink was, but I can remember my first drunk with amazing clarity. And growing up, I was in a meeting the other day, and he talked about he called himself an agitated kid. And I didn't, that wasn't my experience. Like, I wanted to do and like get into everything. And I did. It caused a lot of problems. But I wanted to engage with everything. I remember having things happen as a kid, but nothing where I'd be like, nothing where I thought there were going to be problems in the future. It's a little disjointed tonight. I also remember and have some pictures of me as like an 8 or 9 year old with a glass of beer. I know where we were on vacation with my family, and I've got glasses, a mug, looked kind of like a grenade, and it had beer in it. I'm holding it, and you can see me looking at it, and I'm excited. I'm real excited, and I find that picture like once or twice a year. I've got it electronically, but I don't know where I've got it stored, and I find it once or twice a year. Whenever I see it, like, I can see, like, I know the feeling I had looking at that beer. And it doesn't make sense that I had that feeling when I was like 9 or 10 years old, if that. My family had just moved. We had just moved. I was 13 years old and we had just moved to a new house. And there was a guy that lived about 3 doors away. And we were about to go to high school. And we had started high school. We were like a week into school or something like that. And a junior, she was a junior at the school and she was having a party. And we were coming in as freshmen. So it was me, another guy who was a freshman, two other guys who were out of high school. And the four of us went in a group to this party. And we get to the party and we go downstairs and I remember it really clearly. It was an open stairwell. My back was up against the wall. My arms were folded and I'm just looking out at everybody in the room. And it seemed to me like everybody had a red Solo cup in their hand. And most of them probably did, but it seemed to me like every single person had a red Solo cup in their hand. And within 2 weeks prior to that party, I remember telling two of the three guys I was with that they were losers because they had to drink. And they drank, they weren't drinking all the time. They were drinking occasionally. But I remember telling them that we were somewhere and they were drinking and I wasn't. And I told them they were losers because they had to drink. But that night it looked like everybody had a red Solo cup. Somebody offered me a red Solo cup and offered me a beer. And I had about 5 or 6 beers that night. And 5 or 6 beers at the end of my drinking would really piss me off, would have really made me angry. But at 13, not drinking regularly, 5 or 6 beers, I got drunk. And I'll tell you, the first thing that happened is I came up off that wall. My arms dropped, and I got out, and I got involved in what was going on. Started talking to the girls, wasn't worried about the guys anymore. And then the night started off good. Now, if you didn't have any fun when you were drinking, I would like to apologize. I'm sorry. If I didn't have any fun when I was drinking, maybe my drinking would have stopped earlier. But what my drinking allowed me to do is just like that night, it allowed me to forget about the fear, the difference, whatever I was feeling that made me uncomfortable. And I was able to go out and get involved in things. And not every time I drank turned out poorly. Not in the beginning and a lot more at the end, but not even at the end every time that I drank did it turn out poorly. But that night, like a lot of nights when I drank, it did change. And somebody got drunk in that party and the girl that was having the party, somebody punched her in the face. Party over, everybody get out. So now this whole house full of high school kids and older, as noted by two of the guys I was with, get thrown out of the house, get out. And me and two of the three guys I was with, we ended up getting in a fight with about 8 or 9 guys. And we got beat up. We got beat up pretty bad. And I generally skip the part of like why that fight actually happened. But that first week of school, I was walking upstairs and a guy who was a varsity football player was walking down the stairs. And his shoulder met me in the middle of my chest. And he started talking to me like, get out of my way, punk kid, blah, blah, whatever. And I did some quick math. And the math said he was bigger, stronger, older, and he was going to kick my ass. So what I did is what I normally did. I just got loud and crazy. And he said, let's go upstairs to this bathroom. We can settle this. And I was like, no. And I just started screaming at him there in the middle of the hallway. This guy was a varsity football player. He was going to graduate. He was doing well. He did not want to get involved in something that was going to cause school problems for him. So he walked away. I walked away. People thought I was tough. I was terrified. And he was one of the guys that beat us up that night because he was at a party. And he was off campus and it wasn't going to affect his life. But we got beat up pretty bad that night, and it stopped when Montgomery County police showed up, and they showed up with dogs, and they started chasing people. So I'm 13 years old, I'm beat up in front of girls that I'm attracted to, that I'm about to go to school with, in front of guys that I look up to, that I want them to think well of me. I'm going home to my parents, who are relatively strict, and like I said, I'm beat up, and we're being chased by cops with dogs. The two guys that I was with, it's probably 3/4 of a mile to my house from there. And once we got out from a place where we were actually physically being chased by the cops, we just started laughing and joking the whole way. And years later, I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about the sense of ease and comfort produced by alcohol. And that was the first time I felt it. Nothing outside here mattered. You didn't matter. What I thought you thought of me didn't matter. Should have had less barbecue, guys. What I thought you thought of me didn't matter. We laughed and joked the whole way home. And I didn't become a daily drinker at that point. I was 13 years old. But in short order, I found people that were drinking and living the way that I was. Found another guy. He was drinking the way I was, and we were the same age. We started making fake IDs. Now, I don't know where, like, 14 year old kids are making fake IDs. Well, I do know there. His name was Ted. We were making them in his basement. But there were a number of Tennessee IDs going around DC area at this point. There was a, I was going to say nightclub. There's a strip club in DC where we would go with these Tennessee IDs. And whenever we walked in the door, the bouncer would always say, "Your friends are over there," because there would always be 4 or 5 underage kids in DC in the strip club with a Tennessee ID. We had made all of them. So we were drinking. We could drink whatever we wanted. And I was still barely doing things. I would play sports at school. I'd play basketball until the next report card came out. I'd play baseball until the next report card came out. And my grades would reflect the way that I was living. And even if they weren't low enough for the school to kick me off, my parents would pull me off the sports teams. They're like, "You need to focus on school." And meanwhile, I'm drinking and doing other things. And running around just, in my mind, living my life. Just living my life. And I was a daily drinker by the time I was 16, I was a daily drinker. And one of the stories that I tell anecdotally, and sometimes I talk and I hear myself tell the stories and I can still get amusement in it. And sometimes I talk and I hear myself tell the stories and I think about, it's like how ridiculous it is and it was. And tonight I'm feeling like most of this stuff is ridiculous. But there was a place called Party Time. It's Party Time Liquors. It was up off University Boulevard. And we would go in there daily with our Tennessee IDs. And we would go in there so much that me and Ted walked in there one day and we were buying. And the owner's wife was at the counter for a change. And she questioned us about how old we were. And he came out and literally pushed her out of the way and called us good customers and told her to leave us alone. And we were like 15 years old. So we're just, you know, living our lives, having a good time. And 16, I come home one day and my mother's sick. She's pretty incoherent. She's laying on the couch. And I talked to her a little bit. And that day I had actually come home from school before changing my mood in any way, shape, or form. And she's a little incoherent. And I leave and I go out and get drunk. And I come back a couple of hours later and she's gone. She can't finish the sentence. She doesn't know what's going on. And I call my dad and he comes home and gets her and takes her to the hospital. And my mother was, she never called herself an alcoholic, but her organs were failing because of how much she was drinking. She had been hospitalized one other time in my life. And at this point she's in the hospital and she's not doing well. And she's in the hospital for a week. And every day for a week, I get up in the morning and I go to school. And really what I do is I just leave the house. And I go start drinking. And my dad comes find me somewhere. And then he would take me to the hospital to see my mother. And at the end of that week, we as a family made a decision. She had told us her choices. Don't keep me alive on any medical devices or things like that. So we removed the medical devices and she passed away. And the next day, I went to school because when I went to school, I could leave and I could go get drunk. And I just keep living the way that I'm living. Less than a year later, I'm arrested, possession with the intention to distribute. And I don't. One of the things my father instilled in me growing up is he said, don't ever call me from the police station because I won't come and get you. My name is, I'm the second. We share the same name. But for some reason, the officers kept asking me who my father was. So that went on for a couple hours. And then finally, I was like, his name's Corlin. We talk about it. They tracked him down. He immediately comes and he picks me up from the police station. The other guy, Ted, that I mentioned before, he also got arrested. We did a lot of drinking at his house. Another kind of the idea that my drinking was normal in any way, shape, or form. We're drinking in high school. When we would go to Ted's house, he would pull out a cot and he would open up the cot when we got there because he knew in short order that I would be laying down on the cot. And generally, they'd keep a trash can by me too. His mother was a fan of E&J brandy, and I would generally get sick. He called his parents. We're both in there. We're both arrested. Both called our parents. My dad says, don't ever call me from the police station. Ted's parents are a little softer. They're like, if you ever got problems, come tell us. And I called my dad. He showed up in like 20 minutes, and Ted called his parents, and they went out to dinner, and then they went to a party, and they went and picked him up from the police station. So we got arrested. And my father got me a lawyer. And at the time, again, just from a mindset of how I'm feeling at the time, like kids get in trouble, kids do stuff, da 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 da. My dad gets me this lawyer. We go in to see the lawyer, and the lawyer says to my dad, he's like, hey, you gotta leave. You gotta leave the room. And my dad's like, what? And the lawyer says, I'm not representing you, I'm representing him. You gotta get out. And as soon as my dad leaves, the lawyer was like, so tell me the truth. Because he knew I had been sitting there lying to him about everything. And I just lied to him again. And he was like, all right, whatever, man. I got a probation before judgment charge. And for me, the big part of that story is somebody on the Washington basketball team, they were called the Bullets then, had a charge for something within 6 months of this happening to me. And I saw it in the newspaper, and the same lawyer that was representing him was the one that my dad had gotten for me. My dad was a federal employee. We didn't have money. We were renting the house we lived in. Like, he cashed it all in because he didn't want me to be in trouble. I just forget, like, I forget when I sit up here and I tell the stories how funny everything was, that it was affecting the people around me. So my mother passes away. What that did is there were less people with eyes on me and what I was doing. So my drinking didn't change. It escalated. It didn't get any, I wasn't gonna say it didn't get any worse. It escalated because there were just less eyes on me and what was happening. My father, he gets that lawyer. I don't get in any trouble. He's trying to keep me focused. The last possible day you could apply to college anywhere, I'm at school, at high school, and my father and a guidance counselor get together, and they pull me into her office along with a friend of mine, and we sit there and we fill out college applications like on the day they're due, and we get a couple in the mail. And then for some reason, they tell us that you need to take them in person over to the University of Maryland. We leave and we're supposed to be getting on a Metro bus, and we see a friend who's selling God knows what. And we jump in his truck and he gives us a ride over to College Park, and we turn in our applications, and we're drunk and high. I got into all three schools I applied to. And I wanted to go to College Park, and my dad wanted me to go to Towson. The decisions were made because I thought my friends were going to College Park, and Towson was the farthest I had applied away from home, and my dad wanted me to get out. His idea was that all the problems I had were a result of my friends. And he was like, if you get far enough away from this, then it'll be okay. And then come the end of the summer, my dad's taking me up to college, and he demands that I go a week early for all the orientations and everything else they're doing on campus because he wants me to get involved. You're a smart kid. Go up there, get involved, do better, da, 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 da. And we get up there and we check our stuff into the dorm. I find out there's people partying. So it's a couple hours later. I've been on campus for 4 or 5 hours. And it's a state school, so there's state troopers on campus. And me and some other freshmen are headed up the hill to this party. I've been on campus 4 or 5 hours. And a state trooper says, "Hey, Cortland, come here." It's like, what? My father had dropped me off at my dorm, and then he drove to the police station. And he talked to the police officers about me and what I'd probably be doing. So the idea that my drinking wasn't affecting the people around me just wasn't true. And I drank and got in fights there for 3 years and accumulated a great student loan. And then college was over. Short story. I come home. I get some retail jobs. Alcoholics are pretty good at retail. Short-term goals, especially commission jobs. I can see the commission. I can get the commission. I can drink the commission. I started doing that for a while. And I did pretty well. And I got a DUI somewhere in there. I only know how much I drank because I went back the next day to the place we were drinking. And I also know that it was the night of the Academy Awards because we were really bored and we had nothing to do. And I sat with a couple other guys in the house and we watched the Academy Awards. I mean, this is thrilling stuff, guys. And when I went back the next day and counted, I had like 22 Coronas and a half a bottle of Bacardi. And then thought I could drive home. And I was in Annandale, Virginia, and I lived in Rockville at the time. And I made it. And like when I tell this story, normally it's like I made it to like a quarter mile from my house. And it's like, the truth is, I didn't hit anybody in all that driving. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't kill myself. And I don't think about it that way. It's like, I almost made it home. And the woman that pulled me over, she pulled me over and I asked her why she pulled me over. And she said, because you hit the yellow line 3 times in the last half mile. And I was like, lady, I do that on the way to work in the morning. Didn't really impress her. She took me back to the police station and it was crowded there that night. And I heard them talking. I heard the officers talking. They said they only had one more. They would be overfilling cells, but they could only put one. There were two of us sitting at a table and we were both cuffed to the table. And they said they could only put one of the two of us in a cell. And I heard that conversation and I immediately started screaming at the guy in front of me. Terrified of cells. Terrified. As tough as I want to be, as many times as I've been arrested a couple of times. I was talking about it on the way up. I generally just don't follow traffic laws and then refuse to go to court and they issue warrants and I go to jail for a couple hours. But I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And I heard them say that. So I started fighting with this guy because I knew I had a 50-50 chance. And I did. They grabbed him and threw him in the cell and they just left me cuffed to the table. Felt like I won. And that night, I kept pressing the officer who had arrested me about where the car was because my car was broken down. As per usual, I would hit a lot of stuff while I was drinking. And I had borrowed my dad's car. So they had towed my dad's car from the DUI. And I kept pressing her on where the car was. And she finally said, "Don't worry about it. I'm about to get off my shift. I'll drop you off at home. You can't get the car until tomorrow." And I pressed her all the way home. And she finally told me where it was. And I got to my front door. And I put the key in and I turned it and she drove away and I locked the door and I went back to a payphone and I yelled at him until they'd give me the car back. And then I walked there and I got the car back and the car was out front before my dad woke up in the morning. And it was like another win. Like, we stay out of trouble. And that's really what it was. It was like my life was just, it was just trudging along. And it was like little stories like that. And a lot of times I tell them with amusement, like I won. And really, I just wasn't doing anything. I wasn't creating relationships. I wasn't bringing anything to my family. By the end of my drinking, I was stealing from my family. I was stealing from my employer. I was stealing from anybody I was romantically involved with. I was physically violent with all the people around me, strangers, romantic relationships, you name it. And like, I would love to say that it was one of those things. I mean, my dad had moved out of the house that we lived in. Billy knows my dad. My dad had moved out of the house we lived in, and he still paid the rent on the house. And my sister and I lived there, and he put the food in the fridge and he paid all the bills. And I was stealing, my sister was collecting public assistance and she was raising my nephew, and I was stealing money from her. And I wasn't bringing a lot to the table when I got here. And what I hope is my last drink, because I went out on a Thursday night, and I told my girlfriend, I said, hey, I'll be over in a little while and go to the bar with the guys. Very normal. And I'm also a diabetic. I was diagnosed with diabetes when I was 10 years old. Alcohol raises your blood sugar, shuts your body down. I found a lot of drugs out there to overcome that. I did them a lot and enjoyed it. Thursday night, we go out. We're going to go out and drink for a little while. Tuesday morning, I'm still awake. I have not been asleep since Thursday. And I'm in an apartment that I spent a lot of time in. And it's me and one other guy left. And I offer him a little bit of the drugs we're doing. He threatens to fight me because he was done. He'd been drinking since Thursday. He decided it was time to stop. So I take the drugs that we're doing and I take a six pack of Miller Lite and I leave, get my car and drive away. And being turned away by the guys that I was drinking and doing drugs with was not abnormal. Drinking for multiple days was not abnormal. Drinking in that apartment was not abnormal. There was nothing different about that day. But for some reason, driving away, I had a thought, and people talk about a moment of clarity, and I've never described it that way, and I probably won't. But I had a thought that day that, like, maybe I need some help. And I called my girlfriend, who I was supposed to meet on Thursday night. And I used to tell this story, and I used to talk about all the lucky events that got me from there to here. And that's exactly how, for a couple of years sober, that's what I talked about. I talked about all the lucky things that happened. And there was a guy, I don't know, I was sober less than 5 years, which meant chances are either the car was illegal or my driver's license was illegal or something was suspended, because the train did not stop when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got better slowly, but my home group thought it was a good idea that I was involved and I was doing things. So I had service everywhere. It was my job to take a speaker who had come in from out of town to speak at an event for us back to the airport. So the guy with the no license and the illegal car, he's the one that should drive the speaker. So I got the speaker. And he wanted to get as close to the Pentagon as he could because he hadn't seen it before. He's in from California. And I say, okay. And I'm zipping around and I'm driving down there, and he's a little weirded out by the guy he's got in the car with him. So he starts talking to me about his story and telling me his story. And I start telling him my story. And I get to this point where I'm talking about all the lucky events. And we're in a little two-door Honda Civic, and he's holding the little handle like this. And he looks over at me and he says, it sounds a lot more like grace than luck. And that's not the first time somebody had talked to me about it, but it was the first time I heard it and started thinking about the things that had happened in my life. And that guy's name is Paul. I saw him the last time I was out in California, like 6 months ago. We're still friends to this day, but things started happening. And I call my girlfriend and I go to her house, and she's in a health class at Montgomery College, and in the back of her health books are the phone numbers for rehabs. So I start calling rehabs. And the first two rehabs put me on hold. I'm in a room full of alcoholics, so I feel like you are people who have been drunk for days. Hold is not an option. So I hang up, and the third place I get on says that I can come in, but I got to have my insurance card. Like I said, I was a diabetic. I was fully employed. I had health insurance at the time. I hadn't seen a doctor in years because I wasn't going to have somebody tell me not to do what I was doing. I was taking insulin based on whether I was drinking Miller Lite or Grand Marnier. I thought Grand Marnier had more sugar, so I should take more insulin. Come to find out it's a bad plan. But I call these places and they say I can come in, but I got to have my insurance card. So I call work and I say, how long is it going to take me to get a new insurance card? Because I don't even have my card. Like, nobody's going to the doctor. I'm not going to have somebody tell me to not do what I'm doing. And by this time I'm going to work. And I don't know if you've ever been in a room with emergency lights, but it would be like all the lights except maybe one of these turning off. That was happening to my vision regularly, but nothing was happening with the lights, just me. And that was happening with my vision. There were other things going on. And like I said, I wasn't going to doctors. Nobody's going to a doctor to tell me not to do what I'm doing. And so work says it's going to take me a week to get this insurance card. So I go to work, I come home, and I get in bed. The next day I get up and I change my polo shirt. I'm working at a big box hardware store at this time. So uniform is jeans and a polo. And I'm changing my shirt every day and I'm going back to work. And that was the first time, at that point I was almost 27 years old. And that was the first time that I had gone more than like a day since I was 16 without putting something in my body. And I used to talk about how lucky that was. And on the last day, so it's been 7 days, early 7 days earlier, I'm begging to get in rehab. Time to go to rehab. I'm not showering all week while I'm going to work. I decide to shower, get dressed nicely to go to rehab because that makes sense. And I get to rehab that night. And I have to believe there's some familiarity in here with rehab. They got some doctor standing up front and telling you about a bell curve and what you're doing to your body and what you're doing to your brain and what you're doing to your family. And it's nothing that I hadn't heard before. Counselors, judges, lawyers, police, nothing I hadn't heard before. But afterwards, you go talk to your individual personal counselor. And this guy had already seen me pee in a bottle in a bathroom stall earlier that night, so I didn't like him. And he's sitting there across the table, and he's talking to me, and I interrupt him. Now, a week earlier, I was begging to get in rehab. But while this guy's talking to me, I interrupt him. He looked like Skeletor, skin hanging off his face. He looked like he was 200 years old. I said, look, man, I don't think you can help me. Send me to somebody else. Send me to somebody else to help me. And I used to talk about how lucky it was that he didn't throw me out. But he got on the phone and he sent me down to the person who ran the rehab. She got on the phone. She didn't throw me out either. And she sent me down the hall to another guy. And as I was walking into his office, as my foot crossed the threshold of the door to his office, he asked me how much my shoes cost. And I thought that was a really weird question. But I also, like I said, I also got dressed up that night to go to rehab. So I had on the best pair of shoes that I owned. And they were a $100 pair of Kenneth Cole shoes. They were blood red. And I told him they were $100. And he pulled his feet out from underneath his desk. And he had on some alligator skin boots. He said, these are $475. Sit down and shut up. And to my knowledge, that's the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever met. And the only reason I know he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is because when he passed away, I found out he was 27 years sober. And in the 7 weeks that I was in that rehab, the only thing that he talked to me about was AA. That first night he broke out of where and when, and he explained the difference between open and closed meetings. He explained the difference. He said, go to meetings everywhere and find people that have something you want or say something you relate to. And if you had something I wanted, you had drugs or alcohol. And if you said something I related to, you were probably telling a lie in a bar. So I didn't know what to do with that information that he was telling me. But I lived in Maryland, and I didn't want to see anybody I knew. So I wasn't going to go to any meetings in Maryland. And I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want to go to a meeting where there weren't alcoholics. So I looked at closed meetings in D.C. And as I was looking through closed meetings in D.C., the name of a meeting was Easy Does It. And I thought, I can handle Easy Does It. And Easy Does It was a noon meeting that met in the Improv. It's a comedy club in D.C. And I had drank at the Improv before, so I thought I'd go to an AA meeting there. So I show up at noon in the Improv, and it's jeans, boots, t-shirt, hat backwards. I had 5 piercings. I've got some tattoos. I'm Black and Native American and Portuguese and French. So I can tell you why I'm different than everybody in that meeting. It's noon meeting in Northwest. They look like this. Shirts, ties, dresses, everybody's cleaned up. And like I said, jeans, boots, t-shirt, hat backwards. But then they opened the meeting and they started talking. And they started talking about what alcohol did for them. And they started talking about how their shoulders dropped and their stomach settled when they drank. They started talking about when they drank, once they started drinking, they couldn't stop. And then they started talking about what they gave up. Now they were talking about like mortgages, college money for the kids. And I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have any kids. So I didn't relate to the specifics, but they had me hooked when they talked about what alcohol did. And I went to that meeting on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. I also found a perfect parking spot. Come to find out later, it was a crosswalk. So I was parking in a crosswalk at noon in Northwest DC. And I parked there 3 days in a row and never got a seat. I was just, people just left this amazing parking space open for me every day to go to the Improv. And on Thursday, like that first AA said I had to go to AA. Rehab said I had to go to four AA meetings a week. On Thursday, the next youngest person in that meeting, she suggested I go up the street to a meeting called choir. And I thought to myself, I don't sing, but I'll go to choir. And on Thursday night, I go up to choir, like any good newcomer, it's an 8:30 meeting. So I show up at 8:30. Choir at that time was probably 150, 175 people. It was insane. And they had chairs all along the back wall. So as soon as you walk in the back door, there's chairs right along the wall. And there was an empty seat. And I sat down next to a guy, Billy St. Dennis, who's still sober today. And I sit down and I listen to two speakers. The other thing that I can tell you about that meeting is one of the two speakers was a woman who talked about resenting her dead mother. And I hated my mom. I would have blamed a lot of stuff in my life on my mom. And she said it, and people didn't sneer at her from the floor. They didn't look like, she didn't look like she was hiding the information. And then at the end of the meeting, you guys did that weird stuff you do. You hold hands and you pray. And then I took off. And that was my first week of going to AA meetings. So by Thursday night, I got four meetings all about it. The following week, started to feel better. I haven't had a drink, hadn't been punched in the face, made it to work. Like, these are all good things. By that second week, I didn't have my four meetings by Sunday. I needed to go to two meetings on Sunday just to get my slips complete for rehab. So I go down to this clubhouse in Georgetown, and we were talking about this on the way up too. There's a guy, we now share a sponsor, and he was at that meeting. And he was the first member. Everywhere I went in an AA meeting, somebody was giving me a phone number. Hell, they were giving me phone lists for the whole room. I wasn't making any phone calls. This was the first guy to take my number. And he took my number and he started calling me every day. Truth be told, I hated that guy for a couple of years. Happy. Hey, how you doing, man? How you feeling? How am I feeling? I'm going to AA and I got you calling me. Like, how do you think I'm doing? No, I don't want to go to a meeting with you tonight. Not interested. Every day. And by the time Thursday rolls around, he brings up choir. Because I had been, it sounded like my idea, not his. So I went back to choir. And that night at choir, like I said, it's a huge meeting, 150 or more. He introduced me to his sponsor and the guys that his sponsor sponsored. That's who I got introduced that night. And I didn't know that for a couple of years. But all those guys took my phone number. They became interested in my life. They became interested in what I was doing and whether I was going to be at the meeting the next day. And I started following those guys around. And one of the other guys, his sponsor sponsored, was a guy named John. And John lived with his sponsor, Jack. And another guy, Jason. And I believe the fourth guy in the house at the time was another guy named Jack. So Jack, and it's crazy. Jack, Jason, and John. But those guys were always like, hey, what are you doing after meeting? Why don't you come hang out? And I would. I'd go hang out with them. So we're now creeping up on 3 weeks without a drink. And I'm hanging out with these guys after a meeting. And I don't know about you, but 3 weeks without a drink, I'm not feeling good. I'm hanging out. I'm sitting in the chair. I'm drinking the coffee. I might be eating the cookies, but I have no idea what's going on. And I am not feeling good. And I'm in their living room. It's about midnight. Now, these guys are, I'm pretty sure that every one of them at the time was going to school, college. And every one of them at the time had at least a full-time job. And all of them were in relationships. All of them have time to spend with me after me. It's about midnight. And I'm on a cell phone and I'm cussing my girlfriend out, stomping around the middle of the living room. And the thought that I have that crosses my mind is the one that always crosses my mind, which is if I take a drink right now, I'm going to feel better. But every AA meeting I had been to, those people that were passing me out sheets with phone numbers on them and things like that were asking me if I had a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was, but everybody said I should get one. And there was a guy that night who was making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the kitchen. That's what I knew about. But what I also knew about him while I was cussing my girlfriend out in his living room was that he didn't look like he was thinking about taking a drink. And I went in and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I said, I don't know what one is, but everybody says I need one. Will you be my sponsor? And he asked me two questions. He asked me if I could call him every day. And that was a quick answer. It was like, yes. And I knew that was a lie. I didn't really care. But then he said, can you follow direction? Now, let's backtrack a little bit. A couple weeks before this, I'm begging to get in rehab. My life is falling apart. I got nothing to point at that's going well. And this guy that I just asked to sponsor me, and I don't know what a sponsor is, but I do know that I'm thinking about going to take a drink and he looks better than I'm doing. He says, can you follow direction? And that precipitates a 20-minute conversation. And at the end of that conversation, and I tell it this way every time because I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if he was just done talking or he really meant what he said. He said, how about to the best of your ability? And I said, yes, to the best of my ability, I can follow your direction. And I started following that guy around. Unlike the counselors, judges, lawyers, police, my dad, random strangers, he didn't point at me and say, this is what's wrong with you, go do this. What he says is, I'm alcoholic, this is what's wrong with me, this is what I gotta go do. Come with me. And I started following that guy around. I followed him around to meetings. I knew his girlfriend. I met his family. He was the treasurer for WA, the Washington Area Intergroup at the time. They used to have a board of directors meeting before the regular monthly meeting, and there was like eight of them in a room. I used to carry his box of papers. People would ask, like the other board of directors, like, who's that guy? John would be like, don't worry about it. And I would just be sitting in the corner with the box. But I followed him everywhere. And he started talking to me about his experience with the steps, but I also got to see what he was doing. And I saw how he showed up at meetings, and I saw how he engaged with his family, and I saw how he engaged with his girlfriend. And I followed him around, and I started becoming interested in what was going on. But like I said, it was slow. It wasn't fast. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and things did not stop. I've lied, cheated, and stolen in AA. It's a lot more uncomfortable without a drink, but I've done it. And for me, the steps have been, there's a guy in my home group that talks about it. I didn't do things because when I got here, everybody else was doing it. But there were, my sponsor sponsored 10 guys. There were guys doing 4 steps. There was guys doing service. There were guys being honest. There was guys doing 8 steps. I didn't do it because the people around me were doing it. What I did is I did it because I got so uncomfortable that I had to try something else. And maybe it was the 4th step. Maybe it was the 5th step. Maybe it was an 8th step. And then I'd get some relief, and then I'd go back to coasting and doing what I was doing before. And every time I've done something in Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and I'm not suggesting this is a route, but it's the one I've taken, I get uncomfortable. And I need more. I need something. I need to do more. I need to try something I haven't tried. And early on, it seemed easy. The next step, the next amends, the next whatever. You were talking about it before the meeting. The longer you're here, like, just, you got to do more, and there's more to lose. And I'm trucking along. I'm working through the steps. I've done a 4th and a 5th step. I did a 4th step, like a lot of people do. It took me a couple hours to write after months of not doing anything because I wasn't going to tell you guys that stuff. And then when I sit down, the first 2 things I write are the things that I'm not going to tell anybody. You guys aren't going to know it. Something sexually I did as a kid, and the fact that I also think I have a child that I'm not acknowledging. Nobody's going to get that information. So I write them down. And because I know when I sit down and do my 5th step with my sponsor, he's going to take this book and he's going to read this great novel. And we sit out in his bedroom, which happened to be an attic at the time. You couldn't even stand up. It was a pitch roof. And I tell that because that's for me, that worked out. I brought in a 4th step with all this terrible stuff about myself, but I didn't walk into like this light, bright, beaming room of like, we were in a musty attic where you couldn't stand up. And I was like, that's pretty fitting. I feel okay in here. And I sit down, and when I realize that he's not going to read it, I skip to the 3rd thing on the list. And I start there, and I leave the first 2 things off. And the next night I found myself sitting on the trunk of my car in a gas station that I used to that I used to fill up at, but was also next to a bar that I drank at 4 or 5 nights a week. And I just sat on the trunk of my car and I watched people go out in and out of the bar for a couple hours. And luckily enough, I had had a sponsor and I had service and I had commitments and I hung out with the other guys he sponsored. Why? Because he told them they had to hang out with me. That's not a lie. But one of them was told that he had to drive me around sometimes, which generally meant that he had to ride with me, because even though the license was illegal, I think that plates were still out of town in Connecticut and they were expired. But I would still pick people up and drive them. And I'm riding with this guy to the meeting the next night and I tell him about the gas station. And he was driving and he took me to my sponsor's house before taking me home and said, go in and tell him. And I walk in the house because my sponsor's house is always open. I talked about all these sober guys living together. The front door of that house was always open. And I walk in and I go up to his bedroom and he's not home. So I'm happy. I come outside. Hey, he's not home. Chris says, that's cool. Go back inside and call me. And I go back inside and I call my sponsor and he's at his girlfriend's house. And he's like, hey man, what's going on? I was like, not much. He's like, where you at? I'm like, your bedroom. He's a little weirded out. and he's like, what's going on? And I tell him the two things that I left off. And the next day we're at his house and he said, all that stuff's fine. He said, now you just have to change everything. And I hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't always respond to it. I don't always immediately take action, but there are a lot of things that don't ever leave my mind. And the day that he said you had to change everything, like I knew, I wouldn't tell you that I knew it was going to be uncomfortable. I just knew it was going to be a lot. And we finished doing what we were doing at his house. And then I think we went and either made coffee or set up a meeting. Like there wasn't anything he ever said to me where it was like, all right, cool, go do this, figure it out. Or I don't know what we're going to do, go figure it out. Or you should do that, go figure it out. Like it was always like, we're going to do this. We're going to do this together. And at about 13 years of sobriety, he and I weren't communicating well. And I mean that exactly as I said it. I didn't say he wasn't communicating with me. The two of us were not communicating well. And I didn't feel like I had direction. And I didn't have the same relationship with him that I had. And I had talked to a couple of people about it. And early on in my sobriety, that was, my first sponsor's name was John. Early on in my sobriety, John said, if I ever stop doing this, call Jack. And that day I called Jack. And I said, hey, Jack, here's what I feel like is going on. And at the end of the conversation, I said, I feel like I've got nobody to talk to. And Jack is now my sponsor. He's been my sponsor since that day. And he has a way of kind of cutting through conversations that he and I have. And that day he said, well, that doesn't sound right. He said, right now you're talking to me, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, who else have you talked to about this? And I named the two other guys I had talked to. And he said, so it sounds like you've got people to talk to about this. He said, if you need some help, you need somebody to talk to, let me know. And I said, Jack, I think I need a sponsor. He's like, all right. He's like, I'm going to be your sponsor. And then he told me I had to tell John, and I said, okay. And then he was probably at work at the time, and I'm just pacing. We've had a half hour conversation that I threw at him and asked him to sponsor me. And we're ending the conversation and he thinks it's over. And he's like, what else is going on? And I tell him two things that I haven't made amends for, because I've been through all this stuff and I've been through a ninth step and I know what's going on. And I know, like, I need help. This whole like fourth and fifth step, hiding the stuff that I was going to lead off the inventory, I'm not there anymore. I know that there's a solution and I need it. And in that original conversation, I told him about two amends that I still hadn't made. Like I said, I'm 13 years sober at the time. And he says, okay. And we didn't get a plan on that phone call, but he knew what was going on. And he's been my sponsor ever since. About 6 months after that, I'm living in Bethesda, just out of a relationship, living by myself in Bethesda, making more money than I'd ever made in my life. It's a Tuesday night and I'm busy. I got a busy life. Things are full. So I'm at home with my feet up on the coffee table. I'm gonna watch some TV. And John calls me and he says, hey man, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm leaving. And I get up and I put my shoes on and I go to a Tuesday night meeting. It's a Kensington Biblical study. everybody calls it Frank's. Pickerel is there. Joe is there. Lou is there. All the guys that are regularly there are there. And that Tuesday night, I'm at home with my feet on the coffee table because I got a busy full life. And I already had a sponsor. I already had Jack as a sponsor. So it wasn't like I was lost. But for me, that just, it's another one of those things that like shows me like what I need to do. My life has changed. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my father loved and cared about me. My sister loved and cared about me, and they wanted the best for me. They didn't necessarily want me around. And now my life is different, and I'm pulled in different directions, and people want me around. But where I need to be and what I need to do the best of my ability to stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. That Tuesday night, I showed up at that meeting, and those guys were there. And I had somebody to talk to. And fast forward a couple of years, and fucking the world shuts down. Just stop. Just like, nope. You don't go to AA meetings anymore. Get on a computer. And I did AA pivoted faster than anything else in the world. And it was available and people got sober and it helped them. And you know what? I pivoted and I was in online meetings and everything's going and everything's cool. And we're doing that for a while. And we're doing it for a little while longer. And we're doing it for a little while longer. And my wife is from California. And we take a trip out to California to see some of her family. And we get out there and we're out there for like 5 or 6 weeks. And I realize that I am not doing well. Like I've been sitting on a computer at home. And I've been doing the best. I mean, I'm mailing chips for a men's meeting. Like, sent a guy a chip in New Zealand. Like I'm doing what I can, but I'm not connecting the way that I was. I'm out there in California. And I come back and there's a meeting once a month with my sponsor, the guys he sponsors. And that turned into once a week during the pandemic. And I mentioned that. And one of the other guys on the meeting is like, hey, we've got this meeting outside in the parking lot. Why don't you come out to the parking lot and lead the meeting? And by this time, I've gone from living in my dad's house, stealing from my sister who's collecting public assistance, to living in a house with my wife that we own and two kids. And there's a lot going on. And he's not making too hard turns. He says, make it out and speak in person. And if you can't, do it on Zoom. And I go out and I end up there that night and there's three of us in three different vehicles. It's 18 degrees and we're leaving on computers while there's like 18 people sitting at home. And I think I passed out Skittles and Monster energy drinks because you might get sober and stay sober, but you still gotta live off something. I started attending that meeting on Friday night and I, another one of those things in Alcoholics Anonymous where it just happens and it works and I'm able to get involved again. And I've also had times not too long ago where I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, my life gets full and I start looking at things and what they mean to me and how much they matter. And my wife and I are struggling. And I make some assumptions about what's going to happen and what I can live with and what I can't live with. And I'm not doing well. I'm not doing well at all. I'm vaguely talking to close friends about how bad I'm feeling and what's going on. And I've got people there in my life that I trust that I've known for years. And I feel comfortable in that because I'm not alone and I don't need a drink to make the chaos go away anymore. But I also need a clear voice. And I pick up the phone and I call my sponsor. And I still don't say the words out loud about the things I'm thinking about. But I vaguely reference what's going on. And like that initial conversation where I had with him where he was honest with me that just kind of changed the direction of what's going on. He said, no, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is if those things happen and your life changes, this shitty scenario is going to happen and this shitty scenario is going to happen and this shitty scenario is going to happen and your life's going to suck and you're going to keep doing it. And, I felt good because reality and truth is better than all the chaos that goes on in my mind every day, all the time. And one last story, and then I'll get, I'm running a little bit long. One quick story, and then I'll get off. we're taking another trip out to California, and we're out there. And a guy that got sober in Chicago that moved to DC for a while, he's a lawyer, and he knows other lawyers and blah, 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 whatever. It's 6 a.m. California time, and I get a phone call. And my wife and I are up with the two kids. And I answer the phone, and this guy's like, "Hey, man, I got your number from Matt, and I think I have a drinking problem." And I look at my wife, and I'm like, "Hey, I got to take this call." And she knows. She's like, "Cool, I got the kids. Go ahead." And 45 minutes later, I realized that this guy is in D.C. He thinks I'm in D.C. He got my number from some dude in Chicago. Do the math, whatever. And I talked to him for a while, and it's a Friday. And he says he's going to go to his first meeting at a clubhouse. And I was like, "Cool." I was like, "You ought to go to this men's meeting tomorrow morning." And the next morning, I'm logged onto the hybrid meeting. So I'm in California. And I see this dude raise his hand and introduce himself as new. And I know that there's guys in the meeting that are going to grab him and talk to him. And I spent another 5 or 6 weeks out in California talking to this guy regularly. And I come back and I'm back at that men's meeting and I'm cleaning up chairs. And this guy comes up to me and just starts talking to me. I have no idea who he is. Not a clue. Come to find out, it's the guy I've been talking to 3 or 4 times a week on the phone. But he's just been a little pin spec on a computer screen. I don't know who the hell this guy is. And I've been sponsoring that guy for, I don't know, 9-10 months now. And talking to him regularly about what I did to get from completely hopeless to fitting in the world and being happily and usefully whole is what's keeping me together. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. Glad I was able to come out and do something I said I was going to do. Thanks. Yeah.